Word of mouth.
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 Coming up on Word of Mouth, could Willie Loman see Death of a Salesman on Broadway? With tickets running from $100 to $840, Willie's modest dream of dignity and community is again out of reach for the middle class. And out with bikinis, in with bifocals. The book and blog Advanced Style highlights timeless chic among elders.
And I just would like people to know that I'm not just some empty-headed fashionista who thinks about nothing but getting dressed.
Plus...
Very humorous indeed. Hysterical, in fact.
There are plenty of examples of androids assuming human attributes in science fiction. We'll fact-check a few against today's real-life robotics. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth does the robot after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of Mouth. Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a journalist turned science fiction writer questions whether the android stereotypes we know and fear match up to evolving robotic technology. And the death of a salesman's dream. A critic on the irony of charging big bucks for a post-Occupy era revival of a play about the struggles of the middle class. But first, in the gin-soaked days of yesteryear, a beautiful woman on the arm was an executive's secret weapon.
I have a very painless exercise, which is taking some extremely important clients to dinner and having you on my arm.
Why don't you ask Joni? She's a professional something.
Because they're dying to meet you. You'd like them. It's a dinner. I'll owe you.
That's everyone's favorite womanizer, Roger Sterling, from the AMC hit Mad Men. That was then. Tina Cassidy asks in the Boston Globe whether the trophy wife has faded into history. Tina's a correspondent and former editor at the Globe and author of a new book about Jackie O's life in the year following the death of Aristotle Onassis. Tina, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Jackie Onassis. Her 1968 wedding to Aristotle sent shudders through Americans and seemed to symbolize in many ways trophy wifedom to the nth degree. Beautiful arm candy marries tycoon a few decades older.
Yes, a few decades older, several inches shorter, and, you know, he wasn't the most attractive man either. But he did have a lot of money and a really big boat.
I love what she told Truman Capote when asked why she was marrying Aristotle. You can deliver the line if you'd like.
She says, well, I couldn't exactly marry a dentist from New Jersey. That's a great line.
But the stereotype is of the ambitious woman, maybe wanting to jump a social class, usually vapid. But there's no question that Jackie had a brain and many opinions and options. Do you think the pressure is on the arm candy to hide that side of themselves?
Well, I think at least then it was. And she certainly grew up at a time when women weren't expected to be smart. In fact, many women quit college early if they had a marriage prospect because they didn't want to be viewed as being as educated as their husbands. But the truth was she actually had more formal education than he did. But the image that she projected was not of, you know, the world's smartest woman. It was of one of the world's most beautiful and well-dressed. Mm-hmm. And certainly one who knew how to choose a decorator. So I think that the point that I make in this piece is that the idea of the trophy wife is now becoming anachronistic. Thank goodness.
Well, what does today's executive want by his side to project power?
What today's executives seem to want is more of a peer marriage. Men don't want to appear like conspicuous consumers of women. Just to have a woman who's beautiful is a little too obvious. She's in it for the money, you're in it for the looks, and it's just really tacky. One of the factors behind this is that women are now officially more educated than men. Mm. It's been a slow trend line. So now it's actually hard for a man to go out and find a woman who's trying to marry up.
Yeah, in fact, 30% of working women now out-earn their husbands. So this idea of marrying up may be behind us. But you also write about the power bride. This is the woman who values career above domesticity. Now, what are they looking for in a partner?
Definitely looking for looks, and they're looking for peers, too. And sometimes they're looking for a trophy husband, if I dare say it. You know, they're looking for someone who's, you know, willing to possibly stay home with the kids. After I wrote this piece in the Globe, I got so many emails from people, including many men, who said, oh, it's so nice to see myself in this article. You know, not that mm-hmm. I had quoted them, but, you know, I'm home with the kids. I gave up my job because my wife made more money than I did. And it really is playing out every day.
All right, back to Jackie. Your book focuses yes. on this dramatic changes. How did she outgrow her trophy wifedom?
The book is about her midlife crisis in 1975, and that is the year when she becomes a widow again. She's just 45 years old, and Caroline is graduating from high school, so she's facing the empty nest syndrome. So Jackie is now suddenly alone and trying to figure out what to do with the rest of her life, and she goes out and gets a job to sort of reclaim the person she always had been, but really hadn't been focused on it before because she was too busy being a wife and mother.
Well, Tina, congratulations on the book. I can't wait to look at it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you too, Virginia.
Tina Cassidy, correspondent and former editor at the Boston Globe, where she wrote about Night Falling on the Trophy Wife. Her new book is called Jackie After O, One Remarkable Year When Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis Defied Expectations and Rediscovered Her Dreams. You find links to more on the article and the book at our young, blonde, busty, but really brainy website, wordofmouthradio.org. Not everybody can make white hair and overlarge glasses look fashionable, but then few have the flair of 90-year-old socialite turned makeup and eyewear mogul, Iris Apfel.
I think when people ask me about my style, I think it's part of who I am and what I do. And I just would like people to know that I'm not just some empty-headed fashionista who thinks about nothing but getting dressed. People ask me all the time, well, what do you think about when you get up in the morning about planning an outfit? My God, if I did that, I would have to kill myself.
Iris is one of the striking subjects in a new book by Ari Seth Cohen called Advanced Style. The book and the blog which inspired it put New York City's stylish women past a certain age on parade. Isabel Wilkinson is a fashion and arts reporter for The Daily Beast, and she sees advanced style as evidence of a fashion industry no longer held captive to the waifish fashionistas in the 18 to 34 demographic. Isabel, great to have you back on the program.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Ari Seth Cohen, he's a 30-year-old dandy of sorts, blogger, now author of Advanced Style. How do you get into this niche?
Ari grew up in San Diego with his grandmother as his best friend. And he used to spend hours roaming through her closets and digging through her drawers. And she taught him two things, that old wasn't a bad word and that everything stylish was happening in New York. So he moved to New York and began roaming the streets and seeing really stylish older men and women there and just approaching them and introducing himself and asking to take their picture. And soon he developed relationships with many of these older men and women, and he launched a blog in 2008 called Advanced Style, which is really a celebration of the most stylish men and women on the streets of New York.
You're noting Advanced Style as part of a kind of larger trend among style bloggers and consumers. What's going on there?
Well, traditionally, marketing in the fashion industry is driven towards a younger consumer. But as I write on The Daily Beast, we're entering a moment where older women are being celebrated in fashion. And Advanced Style has become wildly popular. It's, you know, a book today, and it's becoming a documentary. Marc Jacobs, who's one of the most popular designers who shows in New York, actually said that he was inspired by Advanced Style. Really, now more than ever before, older women are being celebrated for their style.
Many women, though, lose the energy or maybe even the body for keeping up with fashion. And we hear this phrase, age appropriate, batted around. What's age appropriate anymore?
I think, you know, the one lesson I learned from this book and through talking to Ari is that age appropriate doesn't necessarily exist on absolute terms anymore. It's completely different for everyone. And one woman I spoke to, Beatrix Ost, she said, I think that most people give up. In some ways, you should always be in love and never say, I can't wear that because of my age. Mm. It's all about how you feel.
There are a number of terrific videos on the Advanced Style blog with just fabulous women and men discussing their fashion choices and lifestyle. Here's one talking about her decision to let her hair go gray.
It's been about 3 years, maybe 4 years since I stopped tinting my hair. I decided I was sick and tired of the look. And as I got older, it became evident that the dark hair no longer suited my skin color, because one's skin color changes as you get older. I have to wear less makeup. This is an individual choice, of course.
Individual choice, but we do see ads and examples everywhere for Botox, for fillers, for plastic surgery. retaining this youthful look with a scalpel. Are these fabulous ladies and men of advanced style making a statement about youth culture?
You know, it's unfortunate that today it's considered a statement to grow old naturally. But the men and women on Advanced Style don't appear to have had Botox or be victims of plastic surgery. Rather, they're the opposite. They're examples that aging naturally can be equally as glamorous and elegant as trying to retain youth. And I think that for younger people seeing these images in Advanced Style, it just sends a very clear message that you don't need to feel bad about yourself as you age, and you don't need to try to reverse aging through, you know, dyeing your hair and having plastic surgery.
One of those profiled in the book is artist and cabaret performer Ilona Royce-Smithkin. Very colorful character, 90 years old, just full of life. Here's a clip of her from the Advanced Style blog.
There was a fellow from France who used to make eyelashes, and I bought some. And then he died. And I said, oh, what am I going to do? They're falling out here. And so I decided, in order to have it right, I took my own hair and I cut it, and I made my own eyelashes. I take them off at night, I'm washing them, put them on again in the morning. I started wearing them maybe 40 years ago, but I'm very good relationship with them. You know, just like with my body, I talk to it. I say, now listen, I'm very nice to you. You be nice to me.
She's just so fantastic. Loving life. But she is pretty dramatically made up. And those eyelashes are pretty extreme. And she's the kind of person, she's, I guess, the kooky person I hope to be as an older lady. But if you saw her on the street, would you think chic or freakish?
I would think chic. I don't think she's clownish at all. It's all about personal style. And it's funny because we're at a time when personal style is being celebrated in all different fashion blogs, and so often they don't include older women. And the older women on Advanced Style are just sending the message that here's what works for me, and I'm embracing who I am through fashion.
Do designers even make clothes for chic older women? I mean, you watch these collections back and forth. Do you wonder what a woman in her 80s would think? I mean, teetering on 5-inch heels is kind of out of the ballpark for them.
These are women who don't necessarily follow the seasonal trends, and that's sort of the beauty of it. And Ari Seth Cohen told me that he's not as interested in the women who go to the chic boutiques in New York, and he doesn't really care as much about people that just go and wear the latest season's fashion. It's more about people who have an individual compass that transcends what's in or out of style.
Oh, Isabel, I want to thank you for helping us reevaluate fashion a little bit today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Isabel Wilkinson, fashion and arts reporter for the Daily Beast, where she wrote about Ari Seth Cohen's book Advanced Style and the growing trend of age diversity in fashion. You find a link to her article and see some amazing photographs from the book at wordofmouthradio.org. The links to the videos are there as well. Coming up, Crime Lit comes to town. The author of Cloudland talks about his new crime novel. It's set in the Connecticut River Valley and borrows from the real-life serial murders in the region in the 1980s. That's when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Between 1978 and 1988, the murders of 7 women in New Hampshire and Vermont were attributed to the Connecticut River Valley serial killer. Investigations of several suspects and one deathbed confession went cold, and the killer was never found. Novelist Joseph Olshan makes a bold debut in the crime fiction genre with Cloudland, set in the Upper Valley Village where a victim was found. Cloudland is a rarely traveled road in town where the crocuses don't bloom until late April, and anybody not born in the region will always be from away. Olshan captures the fear and loss of a rural town suspended by a savage on the loose. And Joseph Olshan, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you lived in the Upper Valley at this time when the 6th and last victim of the murders was found. Now, what did you, as an outsider, pick up on living in this region at the time?
It's a place where people usually leave their doors unlocked and go out at night jogging on the roads. And I just sensed that people were afraid, especially the people who had moved there from places like New York City and Boston who were hoping to escape the kind of fear of the urban fear of being attacked, suddenly had to kind of reconnoiter and think twice about whether or not they're going to lock their doors.
Mm. And you became connected in your own way to what happened there.
A few people that I knew, one who became a very close friend, were actually out walking and they saw what they thought was a person taking sun leaning against a tree. And she was wearing a ski parka and they went for a walk. And when they came back from the walk, she was in the same position. And then they realized that she, in fact, was dead and was the nurse from Dartmouth-Hitchcock College who had been missing since the middle of January.
In the book, Catherine Winslow, the narrator of the book, the character finds Angela Parker 2 months after she'd been missing, frozen, her corpse, as you said, leaning against a tree. What are the other things about the real murders that made it into your novel? Or let maybe ask another way, what did you decide to keep and what did you decide to let go?
For me, I was approaching it in terms of what I could do and what I couldn't do. One of the challenges of being a novelist is to understand what your material is. I hadn't really written about murders before in this way, and so I really had to find my way into it. In a way, I didn't have that much of a choice about what I put in. I could only really write about what I could write about, and I sort of felt my way along in terms of the actual writing itself. I wanted to keep the writing at a certain fever pitch as much as possible because I thought that that would make whatever story that I was telling compelling. And I found myself hoping to go back to some of these sort of brutal murders to be able to write about it, but in a lyrical way so mm-hmm. that they could be digested by the reader without being overly gruesome, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, especially after reading the book and knowing a little bit of your writing otherwise. And that's something that a lot of reviewers actually comment on, the way that you sort of, with sensitivity but directness, kind of use this language. And I'm curious about how you found a voice as a woman. She's kind of prickly, too. I wondered how you came upon this voice.
I mean, she's actually a composite of three different women that I know, all of whom are very, very strong and domineering in their own way. And these women are sort of like mother figures to me. They're always kind of chastening me and telling me that I should be better at what I do and very sort of quick with an opinion. So it was really, in a way, in my blood.
And Catherine is also a former investigative reporter for the New York Times. She's now writes a household hints column. Did you have to find out all these household hints? Can you actually get water stains out of wood with salt and mineral oil? Or
supposedly.
Something?
I mean, I do know, I did do my research, and so I did find out that these things are possible.
Well, what purpose does that serve also? She's a household hint person. I mean, why did you choose that?
I actually do know somebody who did, a few people who've done columns like this, and I was kind of fascinated by it, and I thought that would be a great sort of counterpoint to somebody who was once in the world of really, really hard journalism and just felt that they couldn't make it and they wanted to retire to do something else, which is sort of journalistically related, but not nearly as challenging. Because this character has sort of, she was living in the big city and she retired from life and to the country, and she wanted to sort of keep her hand in the journalistic trade, but to do something that's not going to be so debilitating. Mm. Although she's not really proud of it either.
Yeah. She, in fact, she writes under a pseudonym.
Right, and, right.
We're talking with Joseph Olshan, author of several novels, including The Conversion and Night Swimmer. He's made a bold plunge into crime fiction with Cloudland. This is based in part on the Connecticut River Valley serial murders during the 1980s. And the town is very much a character in this, I think. Like several towns in the region, you have, you know, the rich absentee landowners and the local caretakers. You have the college professors, you know, living next to the loggers. But it all gets kind of mixed up under the specter of this violence.
Well, I mean, I think that violence is the great equalizer, obviously. I mean, everybody is going to be, anybody who steps outside their house is going to be potentially a victim of a serial killer. And I also think that these events bring people together. They have sort of they can put aside sort of socioeconomic differences and sort of band together in terms of trying to solve a problem that's sort of bedeviling a community.
One thing about this book, though, there are cell phones in the book. People are sending texts. So it is set in a contemporary time. Why did you choose to set it now instead of then?
I felt that setting it in the late 80s would require me to set up a time frame, mm-hmm. which I felt was going to be take away from. I felt it was going to draw the blood from the novel into places where it didn't necessarily need to go.
Catherine has a troubled relationship in her past with a student. She's quick to point out he had left her class, but nonetheless, she's scarred by it, both sort of physically, he tried to strangle her at one point, and definitely emotionally. you know, you mentioned that you modeled her after several strong women, but yet she sort of takes this man back. Why?
When one loves, one does things maybe that are not necessarily rational. I mean, they have the expression, the heart wants what it wants, and sometimes against reason. The heart wants what it wants. And I think this man made a very deep impression on her. And I think that her reaction to him is sort of part motherly. You know, I think that he makes her feel young. I think that she is drawn back in partly against her will and partly because she feels that she has to complete something.
How about the place? You know, if a place can be scarred, like Catherine's neck, perhaps, how do you think the memory of that time and those murders has lived or stayed with this area?
It has stayed, and people are still, even to this day, working it out. When I went and did a reading in Norwich, which is 25 miles away from the town that I lived in, and the reading was packed, and quite a few people who attended the reading were people who had some connection to the victims. And the fact that somebody had written about it, they felt, in a way, they wanted to see what was done with the book and to sort of make contact with the person who'd written the book. And I've had that quite a bit, people who have had some connection to one of the victims contacting me, as if that's going to help them somehow deal with it. And I think it's a kind of scar that, you know, it is a scar, and so it never does go away, and people have to learn to live with it.
Joseph Olshan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph Olshan is a former book reviewer for the Wall Street Journal, among many other things. He's also author of several novels, including The Conversion and Night Swimmer. Now, you can find more on his new crime novel, Cloudland, and the Connecticut River Valley serial murders, on which it is based, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, comparing science fiction's robot tropes with today's evolving technology. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Just a moment.
Word of Mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among this summer's anticipated films is Prometheus. The plot centers on a crew of intergalactic explorers. Among the cast of characters is a humanoid robot who sounds decidedly more ominous than, say, a Jetsons household model.
Hello. I'm David.
What can you do, David?
I can do almost anything that could possibly be asked of me. I can carry out directives that my human counterparts might find distressing or unethical.
Michael Fassbender is a spooky android David in a video released as part of a viral campaign for the forthcoming Prometheus. The performance got us thinking about how current robotic technology compares to science fiction's common tropes. You know, the good robot gone bad, or the android who thinks he's human. Dennis Cass is a recovering journalist and now science fiction author. He wrote about the androids real and imaginary for io9.com. Dennis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So first, androids, robots, artificial intelligence. Can you give us a little quick 101 on all this? What's the difference?
A brief taxonomy.
Yes, please.
Well, start with the robot, which is the most machine-looking of all your artificial life forms. It can be a humanoid style like C-3PO, or it can be a trash can on wheels like R2-D2. And then bumping up a level is to the cyborg, which is often a mix of flesh and machine. Sometimes the machine parts are visible, as in the Borg, or when Arnold Schwarzenegger gets damaged in The Terminator. The most faithful to the humanoid form is the android, which is basically a computer that is shaped like a human and looks, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable from us.
Androids, for example, of movies and comic books now are almost predictable, as you write. They fit pretty much into a few select archetypes. So where's the creativity in this area gone?
Well, I think that there's a reason why we like our androids the way they do, and it's because they allow us to explore certain themes of life and death. What I did in my piece was try to go through what the tropes are and then where real-life robotics is at, because there's some real androids out in the world that are being worked on right now, and they're pretty phenomenal.
Mm. Okay, so one common trope, the android that finds the emotions and logic of humans to be a deep, abiding mystery. What would be a fictional example?
The one that springs to mind immediately is Commander Data in Star Trek The Next Generation, constantly cocking his head and looking quizzically at his crew members, wondering, what is this thing called love, and why do jokes work the way they do?
Well, she smiles, looks him straight in the eye, and says, just try that in hyperspace.
I see. So the difficulty in attaining such complex positioning in zero-gravity environment, coupled with the adverse effects it would have on the psychological well-being of the average human male, is what makes this anecdote so amusing. Yes. Very humorous indeed. Hysterical, in fact.
Surely this is not where we want our technology going, is it?
Well, we already have IBM's Watson, which uses natural language processing to understand the punning intent behind Jeopardy questions. Watson did quite well, in part because it knew what a computer knew, but more importantly, because it understood how language worked. And so it's not far-fetched to imagine a machine being able to understand a joke.
How about the android with the predictable job? Now, this is the soldier capable of killing the enemy. Doesn't seem that far off.
Yeah, you have to feel kind of bad for the android career counselor. You basically get to be a soldier or a science officer or a prostitute. And these are your choices. But in fact, I can envision androids, because they have a face, because they have a voice, because they have bodies, because they're humanoid, they can do more demanding work. They can do more human work. And if you look at some of the technologies that are being developed right now, for instance, in Japan, where they have an elder care crisis that's looming, and so who's going to give care to the aging population? And if you imagine the demands of, say, a patient with advanced Alzheimer's or dementia, for a human to give care, how emotionally draining and emotionally difficult that is. But if you had an android that could be warm and could be sympathetic, but would also wouldn't be tired or wouldn't get frustrated, you could see how that would actually be far more advantageous than a janitor.
Another common trope in entertainment is the android that suddenly turns murderous.
Get her up! 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 Get her up!
So we're thinking of the movie Alien, the android Ash, played by Ian Holm. Is that a realistic possibility, or does it just make for a pretty good scare in the movies?
Obviously, there's, machines are going to go wrong, and there's going to be, technologies are going to fail us. But this idea of turning murderous is, I think, particularly interesting. One of the common tropes in this kind of storyline is that upon attaining consciousness, the artificial intelligence decides that human beings must be eliminated because we're so awful and flawed. And so I think this speaks a lot more to a writer's take on humanity than it does to a machine's take, because there's no reason why they wouldn't gain consciousness and think, for example, hey, you know, maybe these guys just need some help.
The next android type is the one that doesn't know it's not human. So is this a desirable quality in our robots?
Yeah, you really don't want, especially if for example, you have an android caregiver, you know, it's going to have to be physically stronger than us in order to do its job. And so if it thinks that it's a person, you know, that becomes a huge health and safety issue. You know, another issue that's running through these sort of real life investigations is the idea that anything that's developed in a fantasy world, of course, is limitless, and it can explore the best and the worst of humanity. But generally, the things that we actually make and do get weighed down by our fears of things going wrong. And so I think that the actual androids that we're going to have are going to be probably incredibly safe. The fear of boycott and lawsuit and recall is going to weigh heavily on even the most dystopic mega corporation of the future.
But I guess there's a fine line in some cases between the ambitions and the reality. Like Russia 2045, we just read about. This is a group that's announced plans to build a robot human copy controlled by thought via a computer interface. Now, this is by 2045. So they've built an android with a human fleshy face. And the idea is that it would download all the data from a person's life so that someone can live for eternity, right?
Yes. Yes, the singularity. This is a wonderful fantasy that we have.
The Ray Kurzweil fantasy.
Yes, but I just think the future is going to be a lot more boring than that, just like the present is. I mean, I remember when the internet first became a phenomenon and just the things that it was going to do and the things that it was going to solve, change the world and make it a better place. And it's true that, you know, that there's things like the Arab Spring facilitated by Twitter, but we also, you know, we also use Facebook just to share cat pictures, you know. and so, you know, this idea of the technology helping us transcend our basic flaws or our basic humanity, I think it's much more likely that, you know, the androids of the future are going to be really safe. They're going to be really boring. And if, you know, if they come out of this healthcare thread, you know, we might have a situation where, you know, the androids, you know, nagging you about your diet and making sure you exercise and, you know, you actually want to avoid it, not because you're worried it's going to kill you, but just because it's just kind of a downer.
Well, Dennis Kass, I really want to thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Dennis Kass, former journalist, now science fiction author. He wrote about androids for io9.com, and you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. We've also posted a video of that pretty creepy Russian android that I mentioned earlier. It is in Russian, but there's an article that you can look at. When Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman swept the Tony Awards in 1949, it was heralded as an American masterpiece. The playwright recalled that during the play's first run, grown men could be seen openly weeping.
I know who I am. Now, why can't I say that, Willie?
The door of your life is wide open!
Pop, I am a dime a dozen, and so are you.
I am not a dime a dozen! I am Willie Loman, and you are Fifth Loman!
I am not a leader of men, Willie, and neither are you!
Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich there in a scene from the 1985 film adaptation of Death of a Salesman. These days, the price of a ticket for the Broadway revival may be as out of reach for the average American family as an athletic scholarship was for Biff Loman. Lee Siegel is a cultural critic, author of Harvard is Burning, and a contributor to publications such as the New York Times, where he recently wrote an op-ed called Death of a Salesman's Dreams. Lee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
For listeners who don't know, Death of a Salesman is now back on Broadway with Philip Seymour Hoffman as the dejected Willie Loman. How is the production being received?
Well, pretty tepid, actually. The Times panned it, and the New York Times review is all powerful. I think there's a unanimous feeling that Philip Seymour Hoffman has turned in a bravura performance. But I feel that even such praise as it's gotten has been fairly perfunctory.
How much are tickets?
From $111 to $840.
$840. How much were the tickets for Death of a Salesman in that 1949 production?
Something like $1.80 to $4.80.
So it probably would have been seen by the middle class. Those men Miller saw bent over and weeping.
Right, exactly. Those men bent over and weeping were like Willie. They were making $40, $50, $60 a week, and they were working in one of the jobs in the plentiful, humbler realms of mid-20th century capitalism, middle management, sales, manufacturing. Those jobs have dried up. Willie and Linda are scrounging to make payments on their refrigerator every month. Mm-hmm. But they're still solidly in the middle class.
Which makes this a little bit more of an anthropological spectacle, as you're pointing out. You know, people who basically can afford tickets for several hundreds of dollars, kind of watching the dignity of the middle class being worn down.
Well, it's like the change from in 1949 and throughout the 50s, all those lovable sitcoms where conflicts between people are resolved into neighborly harmony, all of that giving way now to the Darwinian Armageddons of reality TV. It's as if the middle class were being forced to watch the gladiatorial spectacle of its own destruction.
Well, do you think the middle class is actually interested in seeing Death of a Salesman?
I think the people whose experience it would reflect, people who've lost their homes, people who've lost their jobs, people who are struggling on the edges of the great cities and in other places, to some extent the play would reflect their experience, but they can't afford to see it.
I guess the point is also not only were you more likely to see a reflection of your own life on stage, you'd also be likely to be rubbing elbows or sitting next to somebody who could be running a company. Now, not so much?
Well, it's true. There were electricians and plumbers and people like that, I'm sure, in the original audience for the play, but there was also Bernard Gimbel, the owner of Gimbel's department store. After seeing the play, Gimbel instructed his managers to never fire anyone because of their age. He was so affected by what happened to Willie, being fired at the age of 63. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you're right. The different classes were more likely to mix than now.
I'm wondering if there's any way to make Broadway more accessible, you know, sort of like the Metropolitan Opera's Live in HD series where it's broadcast to theaters all over the country. You see that coming down the road?
I wish that could happen. You know, it's so hard for Broadway. It's been hard for decades because, of course, in 1949, the theater was an affordable middle-class, even working-class diversion. But then TV became the dominant medium. Theater was kind of moved aside. I think theater's problems are competing with TV and movies, but also the understandable timidity of producers who just don't want to put on anything original. They're afraid they'll lose their money, of course. So instead, you get all these revivals. You have Streetcar Named Desire, mm-hmm. right down the street being revived with an all-black cast. Very interesting, because I think that Death of a Salesman should have an all-black cast. I think that would make it even more powerful. Mm. But you have all these revivals, and even when you get an original play like Angels in America, which is a biting protest play in many ways, that was about Reagan's America, but that didn't get staged until 10 years after Reagan was gone from the White House. It's very difficult to get a Brecht and Viles three-penny opera or something like that on stage, partly because I think it's hard to make sense for an artist, for a playwright, of what's going on in America now, and partly because producers are just afraid of losing money.
There are discount seats for most Broadway performances, you know, the TKTS kind of thing, available for those willing to wait a few hours in line before the show, correct?
Oh, yeah, and that's how I got to the theater when I was a student, I remember. And, yeah, you can do that. But for people who are Willie's age, 63, waiting in line for hours maybe is not the most comfortable alternative.
Yeah, not the dignity of the middle class he's going for. Well, I want to thank you, Lee, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Wish on the moon and look for the gold in a rainbow, and you'll find happy thoughts.
Lee Siegel, a cultural critic who's written for Harper's, The Nation, Slate, and many more publications. His recent New York Times op-ed is called The Death of a Salesman's Dreams. And you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
And you'll find happy thoughts.
Coming up, the high-tech gadgetry used to train athletes for the London Olympics. Word of Mouth gets the dope after a short break.
Your dream is not in vain.
Whoa, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Every 4 years, millions of viewers around the world rapidly track sports they barely watch otherwise. The Summer Olympics temporarily put swimming, gymnastics, and equestrian events in the headlines. The Games are anything but a quadrennial concern for the elite athletes who compete at the Olympic level. They're the reward for working the hardest, being the best, and having the latest high-tech gadgetry in your corner, at least. That's the hope. With us to run down some of the seemingly futuristic advances that could influence the medal count at the Summer Games in London is Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby, who keeps an eye peeled on the quirkier trends bubbling up under the pop culture surface. Hi, Taylor.
Great to be back on this side of the glass, Virginia.
Well, it's good to have you. Now, if we're talking about technology and Olympic Games, everybody must still have imprinted in their mind the fabulous spectacle of the Beijing Summer Games. London, is it planning to outdo this kind of multimedia, high-tech spectacle?
Right, I know what you mean. I mean, it was a gorgeous, gorgeous event. The opening ceremonies, everybody remembers them. I don't think London's necessarily going to try and outdo Beijing. Every nation, every host nation, feels like it has something to prove. 4 years ago, you know, China, this up-and-coming economic power, everybody was talking about how they had something to prove with these Olympic Games. I mean, with London, it's not exactly the same. But if you look at their stadium, for example, you know, there's almost this message of high-tech sustainability. You know, it seats 80,000, but many of those seats are removable, the idea being that they'll be able to use that stadium in the future. I think the irony about the high-tech feel of the Olympics is that it's all in the periphery. It has to do with training, facility, security, the exception being on some equipment, you know, say new materials for swimsuits. But I think when you get into the games, very few people are actually paying attention to, you know, some high-tech microfiber swimsuit. They're watching Michael Phelps try and win the gold.
So let's get into some of these peripheral things, like the training of the athletes, discussing technology and athletes. A lot of people might think, okay, cheating. Doping methods used by athletes increasingly are stealthy, very hard to track. So what's the Olympic Committee doing in London to address high-tech cheating this time?
Well, I can't really speak to, you know, the new high-tech dope coming out there because I don't swim in those circles, let's put it that way. But I do know that there's this $30 million state-of-the-art laboratory. And it's the first specifically built for the Olympics to try and get doping out of the arena. And it was donated by pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline. The idea is that it's going to be faster, more sensitive. You know, the most impressive and I think the grossest statistic coming out of all the PR was that they'll be processing more than 6,000 bottles of urine and blood on a daily basis.
Ew.
Yeah, it's very gross. David Howman, who's director general of the World Anti-Doping Agency, he pointed to Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson. He says that disgraced and demedaled athlete from the 80s, he wouldn't even make it to London nowadays. He says as many as 90 athletes were weeded out during pretesting before Beijing, and he expects to see at least the same amount this year.
All right, how about some of the technology being used to train athletes? Now, you uncovered a pretty interesting story about a runner from Britain named Mo Farah.
Yeah, that's his name. And he was born in Somalia, grew up in Djibouti, then moved to England at age 8. Now he's relocated to Portland, Oregon with trainer Alberto Salazar, and he's running on an underwater treadmill, and he's also doing this thing, the cryogenic chamber, and that's designed to avoid injury. It's set at like negative 220 degrees Fahrenheit. The idea is that the blood moves from the extremities to the core, which dampens the nervous system and, I guess, reduces the possibility of spasm and injury.
You also found out about another training tool, something that sounds pretty strange. It's a high-tech training suit for gymnasts.
Right. It's this vibrating suit called the Motive Pro, developed by a man named Gregory Sporton and his colleagues. He's professor of digital creativity at Birmingham University in the UK. And they tested it with one of the UK's ranking gymnasts. She said she loved it. I mean, it's hard to know. It looks very odd. If you remember back to like Lord of the Rings, the idea is it was like those motion capture suits, except this feeds back to the person wearing it.
You spoke with Gregory Sporton, and he explained the reasoning behind the Motive Pro suit.
The fastest way to get people to change how they're moving is through touch. So more or less what happens, if their joints go outside a range of movement, the vibrations will begin, and most people then correct their posture or correct their movement so that that buzzing or vibration stops. We've also run it quite successfully with sound feedback so that you get a different type of sound depending on where your arm is or leg or what have you, and also with visuals. It's really about trying to use the data that's generated by movement as a means of guiding the mover to change or improve their movement.
So that's a training technique, but you also found an example of a high-tech solution to what every athlete must have nightmares about, what they're called the yips.
That's right. It's also called focal dystonia, sudden loss of specific fine motor skills. Some people point to Tiger Woods. They say since a lot of the scandals, he's kind of lost it. Is I guess how it goes. And yeah, there's this guy, his name is Steve Hooker, and he was the gold medalist for pole vaulting in Beijing. He had some injuries. He sort of lost it, quote unquote. And since then, Red Bull built him this high-tech indoor facility designed to just let him train and train and train and then, you know, see everything he's doing in slow motion with these, you know, multiple cameras, multiple angles, multiple ramps that he gets to jump on. It's very high-tech.
Wow, Red Bull. So this is the energy drinker thing, you know, the just give him wings?
Oh, yeah, the PR clips. As you can imagine, he's casually sipping on one.
We've got multi-view feedback system. It can process 4 high-definition feeds live. And then we can replay and scroll through jumps. It's a massive advantage because you can stay in the rhythm of your session, analyze the jump, go back to your mark, do another jump. And to be able to stay in that rhythm, you can really generate some great consistency.
Taylor, are people saying all this high-tech stuff is going to give Olympic athletes an advantage in going for the gold?
Well, I sort of wondered the same thing, and that led me to ask Gregory Sporton whether equipment like the Motive Pro Vibra tactile suit we were talking about earlier, whether that kind of technology gives wealthier nations and teams a special advantage, and he told me something I thought it was pretty interesting. Let's hear it.
Our technology, in the end, is really comparatively simple. You might as well ask whether Kenyan runners get a genetic advantage from having been brought up in the Rift Valley and you know, and whether that should be illegal. And I think there's no end to that particular argument.
I guess that is to be proven in the games.
Right. I don't think anybody's kicking the Kenyans out, by the way, anytime soon.
Well, Taylor Quimby, I want to thank you for your wrap here. Anything, prediction, you going to be watching the Olympics online all the time?
Oh, high-tech broadcasting. I'll be live streaming them all.
All the time. In real time, I guess, is what's happening mm-hmm. this time. It's going to be interesting to see how these gadgets, actually, if they change things this summer. Taylor Quimby is word of mouth producer and director and a mildly irregular curator of the quirkier trends flying below most of our collective radar. So you can find links to all of the high-tech Olympic gadgetry that we talked about, including a video tour of pole vaulter Steve Hooker's high-tech training facility. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. We're grateful you could spend some time with us today. Please tune in next week for more of what's new, what's bubbling up, and what's been flying under the radar. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Todd Bookman,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's vice president of programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella provides technical support,
and Dan Kogan runs our board.
Now for the legalese.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals, like myself,
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org
or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I'm out. Done. Hit it.